From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. History on Capitol Hill as President Trump faces impeachment and a Senate trial looms. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party win big in that country's election, and fallout after the murder of three U.S. Navy sailors at a base in the state of Florida by a member of the Saudi Royal Air Force. Well, let's start with obviously what the big story is, and that is this ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Now, just a little bit of background for our global listeners here. Two articles of impeachment are being debated by the House Judiciary Committee. The next step will be for the full House, all 435 members, to vote after the committee votes. So it's possible by this time next week, perhaps, that we could have, for the third time in American history, the President of the United States actually impeached by the House. And again, with the Senate trial probably in January. So very big and historic stakes here. Now, both of you have been watching this all week long. Nihal, good to see you. You've been watching this closely all week long. Your thoughts?
Definitely historic. Definitely a situation where people know how this is going to end. And yet, there are questions being asked that have never really had to have been asked before, right? People know that the Democrats are, in all likelihood, going to have the numbers to impeach the president in the House. And then the Senate, which is run by the Republicans, will not convict him. The president will remain in office. What's new is that he is running again for office, and he is going to be the Republican nominee. There's a possibility of another 5 years of President Trump. So some of the questions that are being asked now is, let's say he does get impeached, what he himself would view as a personal humiliation. Does this mean that he will, regardless, possibly even be impeached again if he continues to take actions, do things that the Democrats find as an abuse of power? I mean, these are the types of questions that are coming up. In previous cases, for instance, Bill Clinton, he wasn't up for re-election. There's a lot at stake. And I think that regardless of what comes out of the impeachment process, next year's election is going to be an even bigger deal than a normal re-election.
JJ, you've been watching this all week, too. What do you think?
You know, as Nihal pointed out, this is a momentous time in our history. And not just because of this impeachment situation, but because of the actions that are taking place by the people involved in the impeachment. There's situations where people are going at each other frontally with insults, and there's this whole business when you watch the impeachment on TV of the Democrats and Republicans. They seem to be just a few moves away from attacking each other physically. I mean, it's gotten to the point where international officials, diplomats watching this are stunned. This is the new version. This is the latest version of impeachment. The other thing that Nihal pointed out is what happens if the president continues forward as he plans to, and this continues to play out. I was talking with a Democrat and a Republican earlier in the week who are both friends. Both of them have congressional, law enforcement, military creds, and they talked about the fact that they're really scared that where we're going right now may lead to violence at some point.
You know, it's interesting that one thing that Nihal, you mentioned, how he could possibly be impeached again. And the reason for that, of course, is that evidence will continue to come out. And it's interesting if you go back and look at what happened to President Nixon back in 1974. Of course, he resigned before he could actually be impeached, but he clearly would have been had he stuck it out. But the House Judiciary Committee was looking at these articles concerning Nixon. But the one big thing, this so-called smoking gun transcript that showed Nixon was clearly involved in the Watergate cover-up, that actually came out after these articles of impeachment were introduced against Nixon. It's entirely possible that, to your point, that stuff is going to continue to come out against Trump even after these two impeachment articles with him, against him, have been dealt with.
And let's not forget that, you know, the day of this phone call between President Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, this phone call that whose transcript appears so damning to the president in terms of him demanding or asking for an investigation of the Bidens, that was the day after Robert Mueller testified before Congress. And so, like, Bob Mueller goes out there, says these things. He didn't do it the way the Democrats wanted, but this was fresh in everyone's mind, the idea that the president and Russia may have had some relationship, that sort of thing. It was there. And yet the president felt like he could take this action with Ukraine that has now gotten him in such hot trouble. So the question is that if he is not removed from office, will he also feel emboldened? And his people, you know, the campaign people, the Trump campaign people say that impeachment is a major driver for their base. So in a way, they're going to try to capitalize on this to get their voters out.
Well, they've been raising a ton of money off it. No question, these fundraising emails. But when people say that, yes, it's a huge boost to the Trump base. The implication is that it's not boosting the other side either. And if you look at sort of recent elections in Kentucky and Virginia and Louisiana and so forth, there are signs that it's actually firing up the Democratic base too, isn't it?
That's right. And Nahal, I love the fact that you pointed out how this is firing up the base. And Paul, you are the master of history, bringing back that piece about presidential history, I should say, bringing back that piece about the Watergate era. And it is absolutely pertinent right now today, because the crack in America's political infrastructure started in 2015. It was a small crack, and it has continued to crack. It's just like a crack in a windshield. If you don't get it fixed, eventually it's going to spider out over the whole windshield in your car. And what's happened now in this country, there are those here in the country and those abroad, especially Russia, China, Iran, other places that know that there is this fissure in the United States. And as we press closer to elections, they're going to do everything they can using all of their tools, disinformation, misinformation, whatever you want to call it, to try to divide the two apart and make this about what America isn't about, and that is all of the differences. That's what everybody that's trying to work against us abroad are hoping for, to drive the nation apart. And it's on full display right now.
To exploit these divisions even
Absolutely.
Further.
And just imagine, if the race is close in November and the president, quote unquote, loses, do you think he'll accept that result?
So here's the question that's really interesting to me. What happens if the base or the people who are so fervent about this process don't accept the result? You know, I mean, this Democrat and Republican I was talking about said, we really do fear violence. If people don't accept what the outcome is, and how will we get to an outcome? You know, if it's close, will there be, you know, recounts and accepting recounts and hanging chads and all that kind of thing? Will the bases of these two sides, both sides, actually accept the outcomes?
Well, you made an interesting point about sort of what the Russians and others are doing, but particularly the Russians. And that is, it's not so much that, you know, they were necessarily pro-Trump or anti-Trump. You can make kind of an argument sort of in both ways. But the one thing that they clearly wanted to do, which was what you just said, was exploit these existing divisions. And I'll layer on top of that, what they really wanted to do, rather than support or oppose any particular candidate, I think, was to make Americans doubt their own system, to have Exactly. less faith in our electoral process. In other words, to, through their own thoughts, undermine these pillars of American democracy. Is that a reasonable point?
That's more than reasonable. That is spot on. Frankly, the idea that the Russians and those who agree with them have harped on, and in fact they've pushed this idea forward, is that there is no such thing as truth. Truth is what I say it is. It's an Orwellian kind of society that they've been trying to push here in the U.S. They've been doing it for decades in Russia and in Europe. And European allies have been dealing with this for many years. But what they've actually done is found a way to slither into the U.S. political system and insert that doubt. And unfortunately, because of social media and other mainstream media failures, many Americans have bid on it and they won't let go.
Do you remember the show Get Smart?
I do.
Remember how
99.
It was and Maxwell Smart. Remember how it was basically a fight between the American agency control and I guess it was the Soviet, right?
Yes.
Agency.
Yes.
Chaos, right?
Chaos.
It was so prescient because what does Vladimir Putin want? He wants chaos.
Yeah.
And that's what they want in America.
Well, they've got it.
That's interesting. Nahal is talking about that. Such a good point. There was a television program here in America in the 1960s, right during the height of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviets.
It was a comedy.
It was a comedy. It was very funny. I loved it.
Yeah. Well, it's not funny now, and I think JJ and Nahal have clearly made that point. To me, that's the interesting and scary thing. And as we look at sort of the election, are our voting systems secure, and can they be hacked, and who would exploit that? These are all questions that delicious questions for the Russians.
And they're not at all resolved or answered yet.
So which is why Trump, what's the phrase you said? Trump is kind of like slithered.
Well, I didn't say
this.
He did, but I
Russians
said
have.
The Russians did, but there are those who do say that, though. But I didn't say that, though.
So what the president is doing, though, he is latching on to this kind of truth is what you make of it. Facts are what you make of it. Everybody has their alternative facts.
Yeah.
These things, I think, undermine our democracy in kind of a broad way, too, don't they?
I have a little nephew and a little niece, and honestly, I worry about how they are going to consume information in the future. I worry about how they're going to deal with a world where disinformation and misinformation are the norm. It's very alarming to me as a person, and I just think anyone, if you believe in democracy, if you want control versus chaos in the world, you have to worry about the way that governments and these agents and politicians present information. And I'm all about trying to figure out a way to help my nephew and niece navigate this in the future.
That's interesting. And on top of that, kind of delving off to another area here, you've got things like fake videos that are really getting quite sophisticated that can also present differing versions of the truth as well. And you kind of get this foreboding sense that that 2020, we're going to see a bunch of that stuff all of a sudden inserted into the political mainstream. That's just my fear.
It's mind-blowing when you think about it. And Nahal, you again nailed another big point, is what are the younger people going to make of all of this? And you ask about this question about the way forward. And what I have found to my delight and surprise is that there is a group of people, journalists, that are out there that are pretty small right now, but they are working very hard to counteract this whole idea that the only way you can learn is through social or digital media. They're promoting face-to-face contacts. And they're trying to do that in schools. They're trying to do that with organizations, communities. There are people here in the States, people in other countries. It's a very small group of people. But that is what they see as the idea.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking about this, no doubt, for probably the rest of our lives.
I'm sure.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Nahal Tusi, Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. Prime Minister Boris Johnson bet big in Great Britain's an election, and that bet appears to have paid off. His Conservative Party, the Tories, has won a big victory. The question, what does this mean for Brexit, the plan to leave the European Union, plus some other things we'll get to? Nahal, you first.
I think it's safe to predict that Brexit is going to happen. I believe January 31st is the date. Boris Johnson won enough numbers that he'll probably be able to get his Brexit deal with the European Union through the Parliament. Now, look, anything is possible. I mean, this is Britain and who thought Brexit was going to happen in the first place. But, so it looks like he's got an easier path. And then once that happens, then he will try to simultaneously strike a deal with the U.S. on trade and a deal with the EU on trade, playing each other off. And interestingly, I think President Trump might view Boris's victory as a good sign for himself in 2020.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, could it signal anything about the American election? I mean, Johnson, this whole trend of deglobalization, which Trump Trump is obviously the most visible example of that, Boris Johnson as well. Every country on its own. Is that kind of say anything about our own election? Or?
I might want to disagree a tad bit about that. I agree on the premises that there's total chaos there and they know they have to do something. But I think observing what took place in the UK, this is their third go-round. I think this is their third prime minister, if I'm correct.
That is correct.
In like 3 years.
In a short period of time. Because of
David Cameron and Theresa May.
Because of that analogy that you mentioned earlier, and I love that I'm going to bring it back, the control versus chaos thing. You know, Britain is right there in the heart of Russian dirty money and Russian disinformation, and there are oligarchs there who own soccer teams and people connected to the Russian, to the Kremlin, to the whole problem. Here in the U.S., that might present a glimmer of hope, but this electorate here is very different. The issues here are very different. And I do think, though, what we're facing right now is very different from what Britain is facing, if only because of the characters that are involved here. You've got the president, then you've got the Democrats, then you've got the Republicans, and then you've got the American people, many of whom are deadlocked and many of whom have locked on to their candidates and are not budging on anything. The other really key thing about this Boris Johnson-Trump thing, the president avoided him at the NATO summit. And I'm not sure that it's going to be a slam dunk for him to try to do or to work on a trade deal with the U.S. because of what took place. And you might remember that whole Macron and Justin Trudeau little thing that took place at the cocktail party where they were snickering about the president. Well, Boris Johnson was in that too. So we have to remember that.
Look, this was a very calculated thing on Boris and Trump's part. They intentionally avoided one another the last few weeks. Why? Because Trump is so unpopular in Britain that Boris was worried that it would hurt him at the polls. I think a couple of things we have to bear in mind. Boris himself is not really that well-liked, but, you know, he's kind of the best they could do, the Conservatives at the time. But he was running against a guy who was even more disliked, Jeremy Corbyn, the socialist leader of the Labour Party, who's faced numerous accusations of anti-Semitism and other types of things. And a lot of the people have bolted Labour, not because they like Boris, but because they hate Jeremy Corbyn. And I think, look,
so here's the lesser of two evils.
Well, in their minds. Now, look, I think people are trying to make this analogy. They're saying, oh, this is like a sign that the Democrats' leftist message is not going to play well in 2020, et cetera, et cetera. I think the bigger lesson is you need to put up a candidate that voters will like more than the other guy. And that's arguably the reason that Trump won in the first place, is that people disliked Hillary Clinton
so
much.
What a concept.
So, you know, Democrats need to, this idea of electability among Democrats, I think that's something often people will be like, oh, why would people worry about that electability? You know, it only gives advantage to the white male, et cetera, et cetera. But look, I think after last night, you have to think, maybe electability is something people need to consider if they want to get Trump out of office.
It's interesting. Let me read both of you here something that I read in the British press this morning. Here's a key point about Johnson. I'll read it. You two react to this. No longer will Boris Johnson be forced to pander to the extremes of his party, the hardcore Brexiters of the European Research Group on the right and the softcore Remainers toward the center, nor will he be in hock to the hardliners in Northern Ireland, that kind of thing. This could be now quite a very strong prime minister who's going to get his way. That's what they appear to be saying.
That's right. And one of the interesting things about Boris's efforts in recent weeks is that he, unlike Trump, who, you know, often just wants to burnish his base and strengthen his base, Boris has tried to reach across the so-called aisle. I mean, he has made moves and said things. For instance, he doesn't want to pursue these harsh austerity programs. He is not trying to destroy the National Health Service, you know, those sorts of things. And so he's trying to appeal to a broader segment. And that's a sign of someone who now, the numbers he's won, he's probably going to feel more comfortable governing that way as well, because he doesn't have to pander to the people whose seats he needs to keep him in power, because now there's just so many more seats that he has. Another thing is people often compare Boris and Trump. And, you know, it's funny, I use the word Boris, but that's really how he's known. His last name is Johnson. And they say, oh, they're so similar. And Trump himself has said, oh, he's the Britain Trump. But, you know, beyond like the hair and the occasional populist outreach and the, frankly, slipperiness with the truth, there's big differences between the British prime minister and the U.S. president. I mean, Boris Johnson comes from the British elite. He went to Eton. He went to Oxford. He is very much kind of an establishment guy for the most part. He believes in the Paris Climate Agreement. He wants to stay in the Iran nuclear deal. And so it's important to remember that the analogy only goes so far with
this. It's interesting. And when he was the mayor of London, he was regarded as pretty left-wing kind of a mayor, too.
Well, I mean, London's a very diverse city. And when he was mayor of London, he also said that Trump was unfit to serve as president, that he was clearly out of his mind, and a number of other insulting things to President Trump.
Well, let's move on. Here in the United States, the Pentagon has suspended operational training for all Saudi military students here, indefinitely halting flight instruction, firing range training, and all other operations outside of the classroom. This, of course, in the wake of a shooting in recent days at a Navy base in Florida that left three Americans dead, and the killer was a member of the Saudi Royal Air Force. JJ, how much damage to these ties between Washington and Riyadh? How much damage has been done?
There are two levels. Looking at the military side of this, a lot. Looking at the political side, not much visibly. But when you look at the military problem here, you have three members of the U.S. military that have been killed by an individual who now we found out within the last day or so, who perhaps had been radicalized years before he came to the United States. But then there was a scenario that unfolded on this base where he supposedly had dinner parties where, you know, videos of mass shootings were shown, and some of the people who viewed them were his fellow Saudi airmen, but people who were also on this base for training as well. And there were those who knew about it, apparently, some who watched, another who videotaped. So what this says to the U.S. military, from my view, is that we really do have to look very carefully at this relationship and how we handle this with these people, not just from Saudi Arabia, but from everywhere. It all supposedly was triggered by an insult, you know, in the classroom, by an instructor who was a contractor working for the military, supposedly. But then there was the background of it. So the U.S. military recognizes that there are threats, there are risks, not just abroad, but here at home, and they have to be even more careful about how they vet people and engage with them here on home soil as well.
And Nahal, you know, when you think about it and go back in time, I seem to recall that the September 11th, 2001 attacks, of the 19 hijackers, 15 of them were Saudis. So the question is, why are they considered an American ally?
Oh, wow. That is a big question. But honestly, it comes down to differing between the Saudi people and the Saudi government. And the U.S. government has long done that. The Saudi government has been an ally of the U.S. against communism and against Iran. And so the idea being that you cannot hold the Saudi government responsible for the actions of individuals that it doesn't necessarily control, and that they offer so much on counterterrorism, intelligence cooperation. And I should add, they buy a lot of American weapons, billions and billions and billions of dollars of American weapons. And so that's also a factor in the U.S. relationship with the Saudis.
Now, it's also true, JJ, that they've spent an awful lot of money very quietly over the years, funneling things like, you know, Wahhabi Islam and so forth. That's all true as well.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that a lot of people have been looking at for years, which is why a part of this has a political bent to it, too, because Wahhabism is it's a very narrow view of, I guess, a religious ideology, and it's not very positive towards others outside of the thinking process of Wahhabism. But, you know, they do, and they have been injecting money into schools and organizations in the U.S. that have fostered that ideology, and there are those that believe that people like this airman may have been victim to some of that negative thinking about the U.S. and others that led to this situation. But look, the bottom line on this is what took place was something, a personal decision that this individual made. He made that decision. The others who may be involved with him made that decision. The thing that investigators are now trying to figure out is, are there others who thought like him, and are they out there now? They know they took several trips, one of which was to New York. And again, you mentioned the 15 Saudis that were involved in 9/11. That brings back memories to people of the Hamburg cell who were here in Germany and other places, just kind of quietly doing their thing. This is the problem that the military and the intelligence community is wrestling with now. Are there others who think like this person who pulled that trigger?
But, you know, the other side of this, when people say, look, that they do support having these kinds of relationships, training these Saudis, is that when you expose these Saudi soldiers to America, probably most of them might end up liking it, and that it could foster pro-American feelings. So that's worth considering as well.
It's a good thing. Definitely a good thing to expose them to it.
We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Nahal Tusi of Politico, also J.J. Green. He's national correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer, Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today. Thanks for joining us.